Welcome to Solutions for Higher Education, a podcast by Scott L. Wyatt, president of Southern Utah University in Cedar City, Utah. To subscribe to this podcast, please visit www.suu.edu/presidentspodcast, where you will find both the audio and a written transcript for today's podcast. Hi again, everyone, and welcome to Solutions for Higher Education, a podcast featuring Scott L. Wyatt, the president of Southern Utah University in Cedar City, Utah. I'm your host, Steve Meredith, and I'm joined in studio today, as I always am, by President Wyatt. Scott, how are you?
Terrific, Steve. Thank you very much.
It's, I think maybe we have the best weather anywhere in the United States today. Perfectly clear, 75 degrees, not a cloud in the sky, low humidity. It's pretty spectacular.
And up in the tops of the mountains, the leaves are just starting.
Just starting to turn a little bit. So it's a nice time to be in Southern Utah. It's always nice to be here, but especially nice today. So, President, you and I continuing to talk about innovative thoughts and innovative ideas. And we had last week a discussion about competency-based education in general education with some leaders from our state office up in Salt Lake City. And today we have somebody with some new and interesting, and in the very title of her article, radical ideas about how we could change.
Provocative.
Yeah. About general education. So I'll let you introduce her.
Well, we're delighted to be joined today by Dr. Megan Fromm, who is presently a teacher at Grand Junction High School.
Yeah, teaching journalism.
Teaching journalism. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thank you for being willing to throw out ideas that we can talk about.
Absolutely.
So you have an idea about general education, and what we have discovered is that general education isn't the same everywhere. There are a number of schools that have no general education.
Right.
I think in our region, it's mandatory by our accreditors.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But some schools that are very prestigious schools don't have general education. But you think mm-hmm. that we should look at it a little differently. Tell us how you came to this. But first of all, tell us your story. We need to start with you.
Yeah, you have an interesting career arc. We've been reading a little bit about you, and we're fascinated by somebody that would choose to go from higher education to high school. Very often the pathway is the opposite direction.
That's so true. Well, I went to school to be a journalist, and when I graduated with my bachelor's, it was right at the crux of really what we think of the digital media age. And I worked a little bit as a journalist and ultimately decided that I was more curious about where journalism was headed and, you know, what we should be thinking about. And so I went back and I got my PhD and spent about 8 years after that in higher ed in various facets. And then ultimately last year decided to go back and transition to high school. I'm a scholar of the First Amendment, and one of my passions is really looking at how we teach students to use their voice for civic good and for purpose in society. And in my time in higher ed, I just kind of wondered, like, what's happening at other levels? You know, why are my students coming into my classroom with certain dispositions? And I was just really curious what that looked like. And so, you know, you kind of knock and fate knocks back, and a position opened up, and it was the perfect one to explore that. And so this is my second year at the high school level, and it's been just eye-opening on all sorts of levels. Awesome, just invigorating, but also I think has left me with more questions than answers so far. So we'll see what we can discover today, but I'm really excited to talk about it.
Well, congratulations for being willing to do something that is authentic to you and that might be considered as being backwards for progress in a career.
Thank you. You know, I was surprised. You know, there's definitely, I think, a perspective in a higher education about the different camps of education and different levels. And the more I think they work together and understand each other, we will all just be so much better educators. So I'm excited to be part of the conversations that are bringing that gap. It's been a lot of fun.
There's some discussion going on nationally about general education. Perhaps not enough.
Right.
Yeah.
But you've come to the conclusion that general education is broke.
Right.
What led you to that feeling?
So in my adventures in higher ed, I worked in a variety of positions, and partly it was moving around a lot. My husband was in the Air Force at the time. I was able to experience general education at a variety of institutions. The University of Maryland as part of my PhD program and teaching there. Towson University, Johns Hopkins, Boise State, and then later here in Colorado. And, you know, everybody has their own version of general education. And what you mentioned at the start, you know, general education and core requirements are different everywhere. Some places don't have them. And when we think about them just in theory as this uniting foundational experience for our students, my perspective was we just weren't getting there. Like, I was getting students who couldn't see the connections between a class, you know, this general education core biology requirement that they felt like they didn't need to take, or they felt like didn't apply to their major. And I was getting just frustrated by the lack of perspective with my students. And, you know, really can you really, like, they didn't design their education this way. They didn't design the degree path this way. And so we kind of needed to step back and see, you know, what are we ultimately hoping to accomplish with this general core? And are we meeting that? And to me, the answer in most cases, especially at state universities and state colleges with accreditation, you know, to me, the answer was, we're just not doing that yet. And so I think a radical change is coming, and I think it's necessary. So I hope that that's where we're headed.
What do you think that we are most missing?
I think we're most missing an interdisciplinary approach. I feel like we still have, and when I was writing this piece that you referenced, sort of this idea of what would a new core look like, and I was looking at the core requirements, mostly at different Colorado universities, and they're still pretty siloed. You know, you still have like your class in humanities or history, you have a health and wellness, you have maybe government and politics, and there just wasn't a lot of crossover. And for students who are increasingly coming to universities looking for that specialization, it was hard for them to make connections. And then I also felt like because of the structures of K through 12, students were coming to school not knowing that they can and should make their own connections. So there's this like noise sort of in the atmosphere with my students about these general education classes and what worth they offered my students. And so, you know, I think part of it is an articulation problem. I think sometimes schools don't articulate their philosophy and their vision behind these classes. And if that doesn't trickle down to the students, then they don't feel that. And then I think part of it is just they're too siloed. We really need to look at ways to connect them and ways to root them, I think, in communities and ways to root them in the places where our students are at now.
So you're talking about moving us from, or you're proposing or trying to get a discussion going about moving general education from being a series of subject matter courses to something that is not really discipline-based, but rather skills in very important areas, social, community sort of areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when I think about what the new core can look like, I think in terms of skills, and I also think in terms of what we think of citizenship and sort of this idea of like, what is the global citizen? I think there's a danger in that too, because we want our students to be rooted in their communities and in the civic life and the civic processes that impact them. So I think you want to have that balance, but I do think that instead of, you know, this departmentalized approach or, you know, a college approach, that we really want to start thinking about how we can kind of cross paths. And I think that really, maybe, you know, one of the things that drove me to think about this is a class that I co-taught with somebody in political science, and coming from a mass communication background, we came at this class from totally different positions, and it was the most fun teaching, and the students got so much out of it because we really were strangers to each other in the true sense. I didn't know the professor that well, but we were strangers in each other's lands, and we were strangers in each other's fields. And the students got to observe what it looks like intellectually to be curious and to be a stranger in this new intellectual landscape. And then we got to like take them on that journey with us. And so we co-taught a class that mixed media and politics, and I think really modeled what curiosity should look like at the university level. And so that kind of got me thinking, like, it's more expensive. You know, you have to have more faculty, you have to have the space for it. There are all these barriers to doing it that way. But it was sort of one sign to me of like, oh, this could be really cool.
Yeah, I thinking about what you're discussing reminds me of an experience that, it reminds me of experiences that I had when I took general ed. I had my major, and then I had to take these other classes, and sometimes it was interesting, and sometimes I didn't see the relevance. But to bring it to more, I didn't see the relevance until later.
Mm-hmm.
And then 10 or 15 years later, I thought, oh, wow, I wish I had paid more attention, because now I see that it's important to me. But I remember one of my daughters was taking a research writing class, part of general education requirements, core requirements, and she was assigned a topic that the whole class was assigned, so that the teacher could talk about the research and, you know, where to go look, and they could have discussions about the topic to help everybody build a good paper that made perfect mm-hmm. sense. But it ended up being a topic that she didn't like. And she came home and she said, this is what it is. And I said, oh, that is awesome, because we're going to be able to have some great father-daughter time here, because I'm fascinated by that topic and I know a lot about it. So this is going to give me a chance to show you how smart your dad is, how fun this is going to be for us. And she says, no, Dad, I'm not interested in this topic. I'm going to do the minimum amount of work. These aren't her words, but this is what she said. I'm going to do the minimum amount of work I need to do to get the grade I have to get to pass. This is not interesting to me. And that's when the light clicked on for me, that the more relevant it is, the more effort we spend and the more we learn.
Right. You know, yeah, I think that was my experience too, as a faculty member and somebody who's advising students on their degree plan and helping them, you know, pick the classes that would suit them. I didn't have the answer either. You know, I was not able to say to my student who wanted a career in broadcast television, you know, why these options for their core were really going to be relevant to them. And, you know, and I always try to say to them, like, the processes that you use when you're curious and when you're solving problems and when you're discovering things about yourself and about the world, those processes span all sorts of disciplines, you know, and we want to, I think, as educators, encourage students to see, like, we don't have to know what the light at the end of the tunnel looks like yet to still believe that it's a worthwhile journey. And so you try to articulate that with your students, but you also want to be very confident that you're saying to them, this is going to help you in these specific ways. And I know that because I know a lot about the curriculum and I know a lot about, you know, what our university offers. And so I think there's also some legwork that we just have to do on the administrative end with schools, you know, of communicating that among our faculty and our staff and really sharing, you know, sharing that mission and sharing that buy-in. And I think that that's really helpful too.
I'm looking at something that you wrote that has a list of the topics, the areas for a new core curriculum, new general education. I don't see biology. I don't see physical science. I don't see life mm-hmm. science.
Them's fighting words, President.
I know. I'm looking for math. True. I don't see math.
Yeah.
Where's algebra?
Throw them out. Right. And, you know, I think that that...
I mean this tongue-in-cheek, but I've used algebra every day of my life.
Right, right.
And I will say I've had the exact opposite experience. So there you go. One of my favorite internet memes is yet another day where I didn't use calculus, you know?
Right. But that's one thing, for example, that I really understand, I feel like, a lot more in the short amount of time I've spent at the K-12 level. You know, at my school and in my district, for example, they are switching back to a different math framework from the math framework that they've had for, you know, I don't know, the last few years. And it's the same math, but we're calling it something different, and we're framing it differently, and we're structuring it into the day differently, and we're scaffolding it a little bit differently. So those things are different, but the concepts are the same. So for me, when I think about those core subjects and where they fit, you know, they should be discipline specific. I could not think of any logical reason to offer my students why they should be in, you know, a core math class as opposed to, you know, media and data class. Like, if that's their major, let's teach them the skills through a lens that's going to be useful to them in the future. And let's start there so that they can start to see that relevancy, and they can start to build curiosity and engagement with their content and with their degree. And I think that doing that off the gate kind of gives kids a sense of ownership. Like, they're here, they're at the university level, and they really need to own every step of their journey from the day they walk into the door. So the ways that we make connections for them or help them make those connections, I think pushes them towards that empowerment instead of, you know, go sit in your calculus class.
And like, we of course were joking about not including math. We don't want to get crossways with our math faculty here, but in your particular thing, which, by the way, we will post to our website. So our listeners, if you are wanting to see Dr. Fromm's writing, you can check that out on our website. But you don't call it math. You don't call it computation. You call it data fluency. And it allows us to tailor it so that it is math that would be useful to a musician, or which is what I am, by the way, to tailor it in such a fashion that a student doesn't necessarily have to have the same experience that President Wyatt's daughter had, where they come home and they say, "I don't see how this applies to me.
Therefore, I'm not going to work.
Therefore, I'm not going to work at it." Yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons why people don't succeed in math is that whoever's fault it is, they just don't think that it's relevant. They don't need
it. Right. And, you know, I think, and maybe you've both had this experience as well, but I think that especially with things like math and science, we can try to teach them the entire universe of mathematical concepts and skills. Or we can try to instill a confidence for students in an area that resonates with them. And my experience tells me that confidence is going to carry them so much further in their life in dealing with mathematical applications than, you know, a survey of all of these skills that they don't have comfort with and that they don't see a relevance with. So I think that that's also part of it is that confidence that we can build that allows them to feel like they can take these concepts and these subjects and really dive into them in other areas of their life.
Let's run through, because I think this is really interesting. You've got six areas that you propose that we shift general education to. Let's just run through them one at a time, if that's all right.
Yeah.
I think I'm counting them correctly. Yeah. Six.
Six, I think.
Yeah.
The first one will make a bunch of our faculty super thrilled. I mean, all of these, you know, somebody gets really excited about some things and some get less.
That's right.
But the first one's media literacy. That's, why don't you tell us what you're looking at here?
Definitely. You know, I think in the last 5 or 6 years, this has become a real buzzword and a buzz phrase, I think, better than catchphrase. I kind of like the connotation of that. But it's this idea of, you know, the impact of media in our society, you know, media as a driver of culture and a reflection of culture. And you can see how it also crosses into some of the other categories that we'll talk about, but technology and device usage and what we're starting to learn about that usage on our brain and our social emotional wellness. And so all of those things to kind of help students think about the media world that they live in, knowing full well, you know, that they'll experience a media world that's different than ours. I mean, we'll all be long gone before we can teach them everything they need to know, because it's going to change in their lifetime. But just building that foundation of what these things look like and algorithms and privacy and data, I think is really important.
Well, to help understand the role of journalism in a democratic society and what seems to be, although I'm not sure, because I've got great examples from history that are as bad as today. but it seems like it's hard to figure out what you can believe.
Right.
Even in the media, especially in the media.
Oh, yeah. I'm teaching a social media class right now, actually, for the first time at this school, and I think for the first time in this district. And I just showed my students a video about a Mexican bot lord who essentially is responsible for creating all these Twitter bots in Mexico that, you know, make things go viral and promote political agendas and things like that. And, you know, my students are savvy. Like, they're in media all the time. But this was new to them. And this whole concept of artificial intelligence and what's going to be real and, it, you know, the fundamental definitions that we've used in our lifetime to determine if something is credible are changing. Those will no longer be useful metrics for our students. And so, you know, helping them to start to grapple with that, I think I'm pretty pretty passionate about media literacy. So I would say, I tell people, like, media literacy is a basic human right. It is no longer optional. If we are not teaching it, to me, it's, you know, get your money back. Like, it is a basic human right. We've got to cover this, and we've got to cover it every day and in as many ways as possible. So I definitely love that one, and I put it first because I do.
I should have looked this up. I forgot to. So this isn't necessarily accurate, but it's my memory. Is that, you know, we feel positively as a society, we feel generally positive about our own congresswoman or man, but we feel horrible about Congress. So if we have a congressman whose approval rating is like 45%, Congress itself would get an approval rating of like 15%. But that the media is down in with Congress, mm-hmm, in terms of the approval or credibility. And part of that stems from we don't know how to deal with it. We don't know how to find what's credible, how to assess it, how to hold journalists accountable. And if we could help build this media literacy, better understanding, we probably could elevate our ability to collect information from the media.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, we now live in a world where it's easy to weaponize confusion. And that's what happens every day. We're weaponizing confusion. And I think in some ways, you know, the powers that benefit from that are very happy to continue to suggest that there's no way out but down. It's just a spiral into a world in which we can't trust anything. And I don't take that view. I think that's a little, for one, it's just too scary as an educator, right? I think we're mostly optimistic people by nature. But I also think it means, why would you teach it? If there's nothing to do about it, then we shouldn't teach it. And I really still think that there are tools and just dispositions that we can help our students build that will make it feasible for them to exist in this brave new world.
Yeah, fun. Media literacy. Where do we get our information? Your second one is data fluency.
Yeah, this came, you know, really as somebody who comes from humanities and was working in mass media and mass communication, I always laughed. Like many of my students would complain and explain, you know, their frustration over math. Like, we don't do math. We're journalists or we're media specialists. To which I, of course, like, laughed, because of all the people we need to probably do math with integrity, it's probably the journalists if they're going to inform us. And so finding a way to connect any discipline to the math that's at the heart of it, I think is just really exciting. I think it goes, to me, hand in hand with civic intentionality and citizenship and being able to see on a ballot, for example, when they're talking about raising taxes, like, are they saying 1 percentage point? Or are they saying 1%? Because those are two different things, right?
It's huge difference.
Yeah, and that matters a lot. And we faced that actually in my city last year. Our citizens passed some ballot initiatives that were not actually written correctly. And now we have to think about the intentionality of what was behind it. Do we even know, like, well, what did they really mean for us to vote on? And it's created just some confusion. And, you know, I think it's all going to be okay in the end. We're pretty relaxed here on the Western Slope of Colorado. But, you know, just those kinds of things to point people towards that data fluency. It's like data literacy. And I don't think you have to take calculus to get that. And so I think helping students access that at their level is really important.
Yeah, the general education math sometimes is statistics. If we look around the country, sometimes it's kind of a pre-calculus like algebra. But what you're saying is that we do something that helps students understand statistics and data computation. We live in a world that is so full of data. It's amazing. We don't ever talk about anything anymore without bringing data into it.
Right.
Every discussion that we have at the university for, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's student activities or classes or budgets, new initiatives. I can't think of a single thing we talk about that we don't involve data. And data is math.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't say we're going to talk math.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Even that language shift is so important. And that language shift brings students into the club. It invites them into the business world and invites them into the corporate world and into all of these conversations where you're exactly right. We don't talk about the math. We talk about the data and proportionality and scale. And we talk about margins of error, you know, and these are the words that we use in the real world most commonly. So let's bring that into the vernacular of what we're teaching our students.
And they're pretty common across the scope of human endeavor. You know, like, mm-hmm. I said, I'm an artist in my other life and my other job, and everything that you just said makes perfect sense to me. I understand data as it relates to the creation of and the distribution of music, and knowing the math about that and understanding how we arrived at that would be terrifically interesting to people who are going to be, for better or for worse, going to be reliant on digital distribution and digital sales and digital all of the things that we're expecting the economy to continue to be and to get larger at. Understanding the data underpinnings of that is useful to everyone from the engineer to the artist.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Well, your third area is citizenship and empowerment in the digital era.
Yeah, this is a big one, you know.
It is big.
Oof. Where do we start? You know, part of me says, gosh, we start anywhere. Like, I was struggling last year, my first year teaching high school, to connect Shakespeare to my students, for example. And I was struggling too. I came from a world of journalism and, you know, 8 years in higher ed teaching nothing but journalism and media. And I had this one class of English and we were reading Shakespeare. And we were reading the language and we were talking about rhetoric and, you know, strategies of persuasion. And it was the same time that this, like, now infamous ballot came out. And I just brought the ballot into class. And we talked about the way the ballot language disempowered them in the same way that Shakespeare disempowered them. And they really felt it. Like, they really were like, this ballot might as well be Shakespeare for as much as we understand it. And so that was just kind of an entry point for them to understand that the decisions they'll have to make as citizens, the ways in which they're going to be asked to engage in their community might not speak to them in the same language that they speak as young people. And so we need to develop a little bit of fluency in that. I think, you know, we need to sort of meet in the middle as well, but we want to push them towards feeling comfortable in these spaces. And those are the spaces of citizenship and civic decision making and literally like taking up space in their own communities. I think I even see it sometimes on college campuses. I think students love to be there and they're developing their own sense of self and space, but they don't even know that they have the right to be in certain places or that they could have discussions or take a nap on the grass. And kind of just this idea of like being a part of the community and being a citizen who is willing to talk to the powers that be and make space for themselves. And so that is, to me, it's just so broad. I think there's so many places you start with that, and it could be digital media. It could be, you know, more civics classes or community projects. I see that one as one that's just such a great area for us to build relationships with our community partners too. So that one, I think, for universities excites me so much because I could just see how businesses and corporations and city council could really start to build awesome relationships.
One of the things that worries me is that it seems, and I don't know that this is true, but it seems to me that the respect or understanding of the importance of the First Amendment, which is one of the topics you have listed in Citizenship and Empowerment, that the respect for First Amendment is declining.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, you know, there was an incident that occurred on our campus a while ago, and it was something that was purely a matter of free speech, but somebody was offended by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the class that I was teaching and just asked them the question, should I, as the president of the university, require this student to apologize to someone else? And it felt like everyone raised their hand. Well, yes, they hurt someone's feelings. And it dawned on me that we have not done a good job of explaining the basic liberties, despite how many classes they've taken, because I said, you realize I work for the executive branch of government, and you realize the First Amendment was designed to keep me from saying what you can and can't say, because I'm government, right? And shouldn't I be helping teach people how to respond and have dialogue rather than just instantly forcing somebody to stop speaking and apologize for what they said? Just really,
wow.
It's really fascinating to me. We had a guest speaker here on campus who talked about the First Amendment, and he suggested, and I think he knows what he's talking about, but he suggested that there's never been a time in the history of our country where the law allowed for free speech more than it does today, that there's been a mm-hmm. continual expansion of free speech by the law. But then that in our social circles, there's never been a time that we have felt more restricted in speech, more afraid to speak.
That makes so much sense to me, you know, with what I've seen as well. I think that was that very specific topic, the idea of the First Amendment was honestly one of the most compelling reasons that I shifted to high school. Because my experience at higher ed was very similar to that incident that you described, just in terms of a feeling like, oh man, like we've got to do a better job, like explaining what this means and the burden of free speech. Like free speech is not meant to be easy. It is meant to be a burden on society, a burden that requires us to hear things that make us uncomfortable and to see things that make us uncomfortable. And we have constructed it in our social spaces as something that is not meant to be a burden. And we've lost that. We can look back to, you know, how our founding fathers wrote about it. And they knew that it was that. And we've lost sight of that somewhere. And so I see that in my high school classrooms and just trying to instill in them the sense of, well, okay, you're offended, you know, or you're insulted. Now what? Like, what comes after that? Because that's a really important part in our society. And I didn't see that at the college level at the rate that I hoped for. I saw many students who just wanted to be protected or, you know, and not in this like pejorative millennial way that I think we talk about college students, because I kind of dislike that. I'm sure like you guys probably hear that, you know, from some people like, oh, those millennials, right? Well, they're probably not millennials anymore, but we also like love our students so much and we just want the best for them. And
yeah,
and they're not special snowflakes. They're curious. They're awesome. Like, it's the best job in the world. But I was finding more and more my students were coming to me and in a media space and saying, gosh, like people shouldn't be allowed to say that, or I'm offended, so I should be protected. And it just was a red flag to me of, you know, where are we doing this at our other levels of education and how can we continue to build on that?
Yeah, it seems like we have two values that are conflicting. And the one value is, in order to protect democracy, we have to allow free speech. But the value that's in conflict with that is this emerging value of, I'm not sure how to describe it off the top of my head. I didn't think about this clearly, but it's kind of like a social justice compassion value that says everybody should be treated wonderfully and we should be kind and thoughtful. And in order to be kind and thoughtful, no one should ever say anything that's offensive to someone else. But who defines what's offensive and who defines what's political speech? And anyway, it's a tough, these are the kind of issues that we should spend a lot of time talking about.
Definitely. Oh yeah. Let's do it.
I used to be an attorney and I
oh,
used to,
awesome.
I was a criminal prosecutor for a number of years, and so
okay. We
would go into court and we would battle. And when the trial was over with and we, you know, the jury went home and everything was done, then the defense attorney and I would go have lunch.
It should be, right?
Yeah, and I think that some people would have been amazed because they thought, well, these two must not like each other because they're challenging each other. They're going after it.
You were just at each other's throats.
We were at
ago.
Each other's throats.
Right.
Yeah, it was
right.
A fierce battle.
Right.
Of
right.
words, of words.
That's right.
Accusatory, questioning, challenging words. And,
right.
And then, but we were good friends. That's the key to fixing America, I think, is being able to stop shutting off Facebook friends who say things that you disagree with and find a way to...
Right.
Respect people. Well, that's
absolutely.
A fun one. That's a fun one for,
yeah.
for us.
Yeah.
The next one that you've got is political systems, markets, and economies of information. That's mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I reread this prior to kind of talking with you all today. And even just looking at it now, I'm thinking, whoa, Fran, like, talk about biting off more than we could chew here. So I look at this as building an understanding with students about the interdependence of many of our systems in the world. And this is where I think we go perhaps from really individual lenses to like that global citizen. And so thinking about, you know, politics and the networked society and economics and how these things are linked throughout the world from probably quite a few angles, you know, from power and politics and from algorithms. I mean, just the technology, I think, you know, are we bound to the technology that's being derived in our communities? Or are we more than that? And do we need to build ethics into the technology? And if so, you know, whose ethics when the technology is global and the ethics are local and these things work together? Like, those are really important questions that I just think students should start to grapple with. I don't think we have answers. I don't have any answers. I have lots of ideas and I'm working on the answers. And that's what I want my students to think about too. I just want them to start to think about these ideas so that when they are confronted with them in real time as consumers, as adults, that it's not the first time that they've ever had to think about it. So that they have some tools and they know a little bit about themselves before they face these concepts.
I've been interested in, you mentioned artificial intelligence, and you know, whenever we see a film or something that has a view of the future where robots are assisting us, or where there's a significant amount of intervention by artificial intelligence in human lives, I'm always curious, in the same way that I was curious about alien movies in the 50s. Why do all the monsters always speak English and sound American and have our values? I'm always wondering what the robots are the robots that are coming to assist us, are they going to be instilled with the values of the people that built them? And how's that going to work, you know, in a country that, or in a place that doesn't share that same value system, and may in fact, you know, that robot may be less useful in conversation or in interaction with the person, because it's recognizing the kind of biases and other things that of the person or the people or the group or the company that built them.
Right. Yeah. You know, that's exactly it. How do we impose, you know, Silicon Valley ethics on the rest of the world? And perhaps the first question is, do we even do that? Right. And who, if anybody, is asking that question among the people who are capable of actually making that decision? My students, it's been fascinating. They watched, actually this week, we watched The Facebook Dilemma, which was a PBS Frontline special on Facebook's role with fake news and the last presidential election. And, you know, one of my students at the end, he raised his hand and he said, you know, I get it. Like, I see where Facebook kind of failed, or I see where these algorithms were not in service of democracy. But at the end of the day, there's a person behind that post. There's a person behind the share. And what are we doing about the people? And that's the question. That's exactly it. And so, you know, again, I didn't have any answers for him, but I was super excited that he was asking the question. That's exactly where we want to be. And then we need to hold people accountable. We need to make sure and have some transparency that those questions are actually being asked at the highest levels. And so I think having a better knowledge of those systems will let people feel more comfortable asking those questions and kind of demanding some of those answers.
Some of these pieces that we're talking about fit roughly within traditional general education components, you know, like an American institution or American history and government class or something.
But, econ class or something.
Yeah. But some of these actually don't. And one of the categories that you've got under this, or one of the pieces under this category that you wrote, was entrepreneurship and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's in, at least I've not heard of any general education requirement. That,
yep. Yeah, we thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. I hope it was very innovative. No.
Sticking innovation in here was quite innovative of you.
Yeah, I hope so. I think this came from, you know, I would say this was very much a direct result of teaching in a field that it really doesn't have a lot of direction right now. You know, journalism doesn't have a lot of direction. Even media, when we speak of this sort of broad, ambiguous media, is sort of without a path right now. And the way in which most of my colleagues talk about student-centered learning is through these terms. Like, well, we need to build entrepreneurs and we need to encourage them to be innovative in their creation, application, and production of media. And, you know, I'm sitting here sort of thinking, like, I'm a pretty smart person. I have experience. I have education. I've got a PhD in this. And I don't know what you mean. Like, I don't know what that looks like for our students to just, I'm going to teach you to be an entrepreneur. And as it turned out, really nobody else did either. Like, in my circle, we talked about this a lot. And at the last university I was at, we did a survey of faculty to just really see, like, what does this mean to you? And do you think you're teaching it? And if so, how? And, you know, what can we learn from that? And the consensus really was, we all want to teach it. We think it's important. We don't really know what it looks like. And we're not totally sure how to do it in our classes. And so I look at this as an area, perhaps not for confusion with the students, because they want to create. They're pretty naturally curious. They want to try new things. I look at this more as the administrative mandate, perhaps, of, you know, all of my ideas. Like, I think as administrators and educators, we need to get a handle on the types of spaces and the types of pedagogies that encourage entrepreneurship. And I think that looks different, you know, really at every school. I know, you know, for my students and my demographic, it looks like partnering with some media companies in our community and learning about how they were thinking about audience and using new technology. So that was kind of one way we did it. But this is definitely one that I think has to be handled at kind of a higher, more administrative level in order to figure out what that looks like for our schools.
Your fifth of six categories for a new vision for general education is social and personal wellness. I think this is one that the average college student would love to see in curriculum. It includes developing empathy, habits of mind and technology for healthy media use, issues of diversity, locally, regionally, globally, social justice and community building. I think that that's something that our college age people are hungry for.
Agreed.
I think so too. And I, you know, I think part of it is the narrative that, you know, the media, if I can just kind of use that really broadly, I think it's the way that society sometimes talks about our students, about young people. And there's, I think sometimes, you know, we do a disservice to just how eager they are to be empathetic and to have foundational connections with people in other cultures. And sometimes that's just perceived as, you know, elitist or sort of that special snowflake mentality, some of those terms that get thrown around. And I see it, and I, you know, I imagine that you will do too. I see it as people just trying to find their way in the world. And the media background in me says we do that when we like tell stories and we share things. We create spaces that aren't necessarily safe in today's political sense, but that are challenging, but also empathetic. And that's where I think schools also should bring in international students in different ways. You know, we get international students on our campuses and we want to integrate them, but also, like, how can we learn from them in ways that are more broad than just putting them in a classroom and our students learn from them and vice versa? You know, how can we empower them to bring some of those things to campus too? So a lot to think about with that. And then I think doing that builds some of that emotional wellness that we also want them to have. You know, we are facing a young generation that has more concerns for mental health than I think we've ever seen. And so that really worries me as an educator. So I want to look for ways to build that into our undergraduate foundation.
So this this category of social personal wellness is, you're hitting it directly as the main public point. Typically, we do it indirectly. We say you've got to take one anthropology or philosophy or literature or whatever the class might be. And we hope that, I think the goal is to help develop that social and personal wellness and understanding and communication across disciplines and sort of things. But it's as you said, it's more siloed in a discipline.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's your suggestion.
Right. Yeah, I think this is one where it's certainly with history and anthropology, you know, looking back is really important. When I talked about this with some of my colleagues and especially the history professors, were feeling like that pressure of like, we really still have to know, you know, what happened in our past. And I couldn't agree more. I think we just, those connections to what that looks like in our community and the ways in which our history has informed the decisions that are being made now can just be made more real for students. And
yeah.
That community connection can do that, you know? That one's near and dear, I think, to my heart. In Western Colorado, we have pretty high suicide rate. And so that's one that I felt like we really needed to focus on.
It'd be fun to get, so this is, I think, Steve and I have talked about this a lot, but it'd be fun to be able to get three faculty members from three different disciplines and then have them teach one class. And we've been experimenting with something at Southern Utah University called Jumpstart. But if you could get a historian and an anthropologist and a philosopher or literature faculty or member, whatever you get, and you say the three of you, your job is to teach social justice, community building, diversity, empathy, all those kind of things. That's the job. So now,
mm-hmm.
from your various disciplines, teach that.
Yeah.
Don't teach history.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
Don't teach history. Teach. Right. Teach this from a historian's
from
view.
From the perspective of your area of expertise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. I think when I think of a class like that, I think, like, let's put, you know, the music professor in that too, because what a riot that would be. Like, what a just fun, curious, probably totally unpredictable place. You know, you put a poli sci professor, you put a music professor and a literature professor in a room. I mean, it sounds like a bad joke, but I think it would be a great class. Like, put them together and see how they would teach empathy. I think I can only imagine what would arise from that. I think it would be just so cool.
Steve and I have talked about teaching a class together that would be an American experience class. And I would teach from the political science history side, and then Steve would teach
from the cultural sort of side.
From music. And,
oh, cool.
And Steve's wife is a dance faculty member, and she said, don't leave me out. So you've got you've got all these components, but I've always envisioned that class as teaching the American experience through these
different
subjects.
Lenses. Yep.
And what you're suggesting is that we teach values from those places, not just teach the story of the country. That's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, I think, you know, probably what really sparked all this is I think I saw, maybe it was at Harvard or Princeton, that somebody got to teach a class about Bruce Springsteen and the American experience. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, might have been one of the original impetus for this because, yeah, what a great way to do it. Music and politics and history. And who wouldn't want to teach a class like that? And then I think for a student, you know, who wouldn't want to take a class like that? And we can sort of reignite some of that passion for the first couple years of the college experience.
Yeah. Your final sixth of six is communication across borders, which is technical writing, foundations of communications, power of language and rhetoric, marginalized voices in history.
Mm-hmm.
What would you hope that students would achieve from this?
I look at this as an area where a student at any campus, regardless of that campus demographics, can see themselves and then see the person or the culture that they've never been exposed to. You know, reevaluating this idea of a canon in our literature and in our history texts and who are canonical authors and what that looks like. And sort of embracing the idea of like a new canon and one that we don't perhaps even know how to fill yet with these authors and with these influential communicators So I look at that as part of it. I look still at really equipping students to be concise, grammatically correct writers. I definitely think, you know, we can't take every skill per se that's traditional out of the core, and be so innovative that we ignore some of the things that are going to be markers of just success and security in our jobs for students. And so I think that that's definitely so important. And so I would look at it kind of through that lens. And again, probably also leaning back on like rhetoric and persuasion and how is the world talking to them? And do they know what the world is saying? And do they care? And how should they respond back?
We frequently talk about the gap that exists between what students are learning at the university and what employers are hoping that they will learn.
Oh, and yeah.
I think that in a lot of ways, we could look at the list that we've been going through today, and there's one way in which to look at it where it seems very much in keeping with the standard academic thinking of higher ed, but repackages it in such a way that it really helps students be better prepared for life that comes after, whether it's whether it's being a citizen in a digital world, or in this particular case, how do you write and communicate clearly? Mm-hmm. Because that's one of the soft skills that is maybe highest that employers generally are looking for. And,
right.
And we're struggling with that one.
Yeah. Here's a place where, because very often we hear people say, oh, you know, higher ed shouldn't really be involved in job prep. Well, whether it should be or shouldn't be, it is. It's the expectation of the people who are coming here. It's the expectation of the people who pay the bills here, whether it's the legislature or moms and dads or students who are coming here. And so this to me strikes me as a way of relooking at the communication part of higher of gen ed and attaching it to a more tangible real world outcome without losing the reason that we teach that.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, when you were talking about the writing skills and what employers expect, you know, I think one thing I wish I had listed like under that idea of personal wellness, you know, and habits of mind is grit or perseverance or, you know,
grit.
Yeah.
That's one of our favorite words.
I love that word. And I talk to my students a lot about it. Like, we would never show up at the gym and get on the treadmill one day and then wonder why we don't have a six pack and can run a marathon. Like, we understand in certain areas of our life that it takes habit and perseverance and grit to develop proficiency. And, you know, and so I wouldn't want to lose that in our new core. But I kind of think we actually just have to teach it more directionally. I think we have to model for students what grit looks like. I think we have to put them in classrooms where one of the learning objectives is grit. And here's what that looks like, you know?
What does it look like to work through boredom? What does it look like to work through something that you don't think you can succeed at?
Yeah, exactly. You know, what does intellectual discipline look like? And how do we apply that for our own measures of success? And I think that we don't model that often as well as we should. And then I think we don't model it as often as we should. And so I think that would be something that I would look to the core to really be intentional about and forthcoming with and know that not all of it might be shiny and curious and new. And there are still some things that we have to like really dig in to get the job done.
It feels like sometimes the message we give to college age students is find your passion and pursue it, which can be translated as find the things that are easy and you love and go after them and make a life of it. And
that's
just,
a, a sad realization that hits you.
Yeah. What we should say is...
How much of life is stuff that you really don't want to do?
Yeah.
We should stop saying find your passion. We should say more, find those things that challenge you and are difficult that provide value to others, and then become passionate about it. What I love about your list is it obviously has a little bit of a media bias because that's where you're from. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what you conclude is that this isn't the answer, but this is the start of a discussion about can we revision
definitely
what people need to be successful in society today. The society that we live in has changed dramatically, mm-hmm. but general education has changed, if at all, marginally. So thank you and congratulations for getting us on this topic.
It's been a fun conversation, and it's a fun thing to think about. So I appreciate the work that you are both doing in this area, because I'm really excited to see just the ideas that pop up. I mean, let's just keep pushing forward.
And Grand Junction isn't too far from here. So the next time I'm there, hopefully you're in session and I'll interrupt your class.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful. You'd be welcome anytime.
Come over here and interrupt our class.
I was going to say right back at you. I love to camp in that area. So I'll just have to come down and perhaps, you know, not my camping gear, maybe something that won't scare students as much.
So. You've been listening to Solutions for Higher Education, a podcast featuring Scott L. Wyatt, the president of Southern Utah University in Cedar City, Utah. We've had as our guest today Dr. Megan Fromm, who is joining us by phone from Grand Junction, Colorado, where she recently moved from higher education to become a high school teacher of journalism. This has been a fascinating discussion. We thank Megan, and we thank you, our listeners, for joining us. We'll be back again soon. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Solutions for Higher Education. To subscribe to this podcast, please visit www.suu.edu/President's Podcast, where you will find both the audio and a written transcript of today's podcast. The original music for this podcast was composed by Jack Barton, a master's degree student in music technology at SUU. For more information about Southern Utah University, please visit www.suu.edu.